Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. This week's programme finds us in St. Joseph's Church in Terenure Village in Dublin. Why are we here? Well, through the doors, in just a moment, we're going to get a wonderful insight into the world of stained glass. So, we've stepped inside, and here waiting for us are husband and wife, Ken and Muriel Ryan. Muriel, why have you brought us here, particularly to St. Joseph's in Terenure?
Well, St. Joseph's has the most wonderful stained glass collection by the artist Harry Clark. There are two particular windows here. One is the crowning of the Virgin, and it is made up of the most wonderful pieces of glass. And the one beside it is the Annunciation to Our Lady. And it's just, they're exquisite. And were made, the first one, 1922, and the second one in 1923.
So Muriel, take us down to the first piece that we're going to look at, which is the Coronation of Our Lady.
That's in the Lady Chapel here, and this is rather special. The sun is shining, and we're getting closer. We're actually passing an altar window now, which is the Crucifixion of Christ, and the light is coming in there absolutely beautifully. And we're turning the corner now, and we'll see now, we'll come to the Coronation of the Virgin. And this is, it's rather interesting because there's a tiny, tiny nativity in it, and it's very seasonal. Christmas is looming, and here we now have these jewel-like windows looking at us. We've purples, reds, orange, blue, yellow. It's just amazing. And sometimes people go to churches and don't even look at the windows, which I think is an awful shame. These ones are just superb.
And Ken, of course, you're part of this partnership, and we're standing here in front of this particular window, which you had a hand in its restoration.
Yes, about 20 years ago, we restored all of the Harry Clark stained glass windows in St. Joseph's. Abbey Stained Glass Studios have carried out most of the restoration of Harry Clark stained glass windows throughout Ireland. But this is a very special church and a very special windows here. The best, in my opinion, of the religious windows are in Terenure.
Now, one would expect that a stained glass window was forever. Why do they actually require restoration?
Well, it's caused largely by the heat from the sun. The darker colours of stained glass attract heat, and when the lead gets warm, it becomes pliable. It sags just a little, only minute in a day. But bear in mind, you know, we're looking at windows that are here for 100 years, and between March and September, you couldn't put your hand on the deep colour glasses without taking it off because they would be so hot. And yet, if you put your hand on a colourless piece of glass in the same window, there wouldn't be the same heat in it. So when the lead gets warm, it sags, and then when it cools, it doesn't go back to its original shape. If you didn't restore the windows, they would self-destruct in time.
Explore a little more of Harry Clark's work and his connection to these windows that we're looking at the moment. What was the family connection for you to Harry Clark?
Well, my grandfather, also Ken Ryan, he was an amateur artist, and he would accompany Harry Clark, Patrick Toohey, Sean Keating, and many other artists over to the Aran Islands on painting trips. At the end of their trip, they would exchange their pictures. My grandfather was proud to display the Harry Clarks that he acquired. I don't know if Harry Clark was so proud to display the Ken Ryans, but my grandfather got the best part of the deal anyway.
And Muriel, Ken was just mentioning there that Harry Clark loved to work with some of the darker colours. What sort of challenges does that then give for you as a restorer when you're working with that?
What I love about his work is his choice of colours. And he started drawing really initially in black and white, and he was a graphic designer, and he did drawings for Edgar Allan Poe's books, Hans Christian Andersen's The Year of the Spring. I mean, he just got wonderful commissions because he was wonderful. So he learned to do very fine work with pen and pencil and ink. So he brought that gift to stained glass.
Yeah.
But can I ask both of you why stained glass is used in churches in the first place? What was the guidance behind that?
The whole idea in stained glass was that it was for people who were illiterate, and they would look at the images in the stained glass and be instructed, you know, as to what that meant in religious terms.
And Muriel, is it down to the location of the piece in order to capture the light?
Well, first of all, the light changes. And actually, often the winter light is very, very bright. I mean, looking around here today now, it's a very bright, very cold day, but the light is superb. You know, so it's very important in order to see the windows.
So there really is something about stained glass that changes or alters the mood of a building as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it can make it into a very prayerful area. I think this little alcove here where these two windows are, the Lady Chapel, is very sweet. And you could sort of sit there and just enjoy the peace and the light that comes from the windows.
Now, I want to bring you back to Christmas Eve and a fire in St. Mel's in Longford. And a lot of people will remember that particular story. Take me back to your hearing of that news in 2009. What went through your head?
Well, I couldn't believe it. This was on Christmas Day. It was on the news. And I phoned through to the priests in Longford, and there was no answer there on that day, as you can imagine. The following day, which was St. Stephen's Day, and there was a dreadful heavy snow that time. And I phoned up and they just said, look, everything has been ruined. Don't bother even to come. But we went up anyway on the St. Stephen's Day through very difficult conditions. And when I got to Longford, about 5 miles before that, I could see the smoke billowing up into the air. And then you couldn't get near the cathedral because it was cordoned off by the Gardaí. Anyway, I set up my camera with long-distance lens, and I was able to establish that we could save the Harry Clark stained glass windows there if we were allowed in there quickly before any vibration could take place, and that would cause them to collapse. One of the problems in a fire is the solder runs off the window and it deposits itself down at the base of the window. Then the smoke leaves black marks on the stained glass. The stained glass, still intact, looks like it's fine, but it has no structural support, and any breeze or vibration would cause it all to fall down.
Were you emotionally affected by the experience, or were you able to stay at a distance from it?
Well, I had to stay at a big distance there for a week because we couldn't get in with the Gardaí. But certainly, I mean, we regarded St. Mel's Cathedral as part of our work over the years. We had been working there. My late father worked there many, many times.
You had already been involved in St. Mel's with a restoration of the stained glass windows there before the fire.
That's right. About 15 years prior to that, after the fire, we were very lucky that we had still got the old rubbings of the stained glass windows. We also had a photograph of each little piece of each window from our work earlier. And between the photographs and the rubbings, we were able to piece together the missing pieces of the Harry Clark stained glass window in Longford. There were two major windows there. They're about 15 foot by 5 foot each.
And if people were to go to St. Mel's to look at the restoration now, what percentage of the original work is there left in the windows?
Well, one of the stained glass windows wasn't damaged so much. So the one of the stained glass windows is certainly 100% Harry Clark Studios. And the other one was very badly damaged. That was Christ and Majesty, I think, that one. And we had to replace a lot of the glass that was missing, but from our photographs, so that it would go back as it was originally. And you couldn't see the difference now.
And Muriel, is stained glass now old-fashioned?
No. No, in fact, there's quite a mystique about stained glass. And in fact, now we have two galleries in Dublin with two stained glass rooms, and they are most successful. There is one in the Hugh Lane Gallery for a long time, where the original Harry Clark Geneva window was. And as a child, we were brought to see this Harry Clark. But now that's gone to Florida, and there is the Eve of St. Agnes, and that is an absolutely exquisite window by Clark. And now, surprise, surprise, when the National Gallery of Ireland reopened after its big restoration, there's a beautiful new stained glass room. And when you go into it, well, I was blown away. It's a beautiful three-light, huge window from Scotland that was in a convent. And the whole gallery is just light.
And Father Philip Bradley, who's the parish priest, has joined us as well. Father Bradley, you get to enjoy these windows on a daily basis.
Yes, I do indeed. Oh, the light, I think, absolutely. It's sort of Newgrange-esque. Probably in March or April, if there's a funeral here, and the coffin is in front of the sanctuary, with the crucifixion window at the back, the arms on that particular window are pointing upwards. So while it's crucifixion, it's resurrection. Sometimes when the sun is low, it beams all the way through and the coffin is bathed in the colours, the beautiful colours of Harriet Clark. The colours are pinks and blues and reds and greens, there's yellows. When you actually look at the coffin, you can actually see the different colours on the timbre of the coffin, and it's a final farewell. We call it the final commendation. And it really says, this is not the end. This is more. And that's the belief of every Christian, of every priest, that in fact we're ministering at a funeral, but we're attesting remarkably to the resurrection. It's just the body comes to an end. The soul, the person, hopefully goes on to God.
And Muriel, Harry Clark is more than the artist of this depiction of Christ on the cross.
Yes, well, Harry Clark actually posed for this crucifixion, and someone must have taken photographs, and then from that he designed the window. So it's very personal. And in a fashion, his life ended so early. He got TB and he was over and back to Davos in Switzerland for treatment. And he had his own crucifixion in a way. So it's all interconnected and it is very special.
And so from St. Joseph's Church in Terenure, can we say a special thank you to Ken and Muriel Ryan and to Father Bradley for giving us an insight into not only stained glass, but also the work of Harry Clark.
Sainte Vierge, an old French carol. And a quick reminder that you might like to join us for a special leap of faith from 8 o'clock to 9 on Christmas morning. We've a great lineup of guests from all faiths and none. With chat and music, we plan to capture the spirit of Christmas.
A spaceman came travelling on his ship from afar. 'Twas light years of time since his mission did start. And over a village he halted his craft, and it hung in the sky like a star, just like a star.
What was the Star of Bethlehem? Was it some kind of astronomical event that happened around the time Jesus was born, or was it some kind of celestial miracle? Brendan Owens, astronomer at the Royal Observatory Greenwich in London, originally from Ballybay in County Monaghan, is home in Ireland, and he joins us from RTÉ's Dundalk studio. Brendan, you're a scientist. Was there a Star of Bethlehem?
Well, it's an iconic image in all our Christmas cards. It's something that's sort of always occupied my mind as well, and trying to figure it out, It comes down to pinpointing a time around that story of the birth of Jesus and when that is. And looking in and around that time, there are a few different candidates for what the Christmas star could be. And when we're thinking of these candidates, we're thinking of things that are bright, noticeable, and also acted as a guide to the wise men. And the four sort of main scenarios you might want to think about are a shooting star or meteor, a nova, a comet, and a planetary alignment. And they're the four sort of main ideas that we can think about.
Okay, so we'll explore all those in a moment. So let's set the date first, because Matthew is the guy in the Gospel who gives us an idea that this star appeared particularly. And we're also a little bit unsure about whether Jesus was born in December or possibly earlier in the year. So what basis are you taking as a calculation, first off, of when Christmas was and maybe even what year?
So in terms of the Christmas time, there's part of the Bible that describes tending a flock of sheep and outside rather than in shelters, which typically would happen for the winter months. So we're probably pinning this down to springtime or springtime to early summer rather than the depths of winter. So that sort of picks it seasonally. And then also in terms of dates, it really is quite broad. So we're going to go from around about 2 BC right through to 7 BC. So that kind of gives us a window of opportunity to look at a few targets.
So it's the very idea, of course, that your whole science is so precise, and yet we've got so many variables.
That's right. So, you know, it is great. We can rewind the clock and take a look at the positions of bright planets in the sky, have a look for evidence of previously exploded stars, that sort of thing. But we need to pin down a date. So we're sort of looking for a middle ground in between. So using this date range and using the astronomical events available.
Of course, historians might also be accused of being in the situation where they were making the event fit the story they wanted to tell. So let's go and explore now the four that you suggested to us. And we'll start with the very first one, shooting stars. That wouldn't really have been enough to give these wise men sufficient time to follow directions, would it?
It really is the blink of an eye type thing. So even the most substantial shooting stars or meteors that we call bolide or fireball, they last a matter of seconds. And that, as you said, is really not a great idea for finding your way around and trying to navigate. It's just something that is bright, it is noticeable. They can be sporadic as well, so they can happen at any time in the year. But there are multiple shooting stars seen during meteor showers, which happen throughout the year, and they are on a predictable cycle. But definitely, I think, out of all the candidates, they're pretty low down on the list.
Comets, what about them?
So a comet is something that it gives you a bit of a reminder of something like a shooting star, but they're very, very different objects. A shooting star is just a small dust grain, a small particle of rock or metal that heats up the air around it and causes the sky to glow. And that's happening up in the sky, up in the atmosphere. But a comet is a huge chunk of ice and rock loosely bound together, entering from the distant reaches of our solar system. From an area called the Kuiper Edgeworth Belt or the Oort Cloud, and swinging in around the sun and then crumbling and leaving behind a trail, but also giving it off a tail of gas and dust that we can see. And this would be something that definitely would attract the eye and will be in the sky for weeks or maybe even months on end. So it can be significant. But when we look at the time period that we're trying to look for, there is a great comet, a bright comet called Halley's Comet, that was available in 12 BC, which falls outside our time period. And there was one identified in 5 BC, but it was not notoriously bright.
And it's interesting to think that, you know, 2,000 years ago, that astronomy was so established that they had the ability to predict and identify when things would happen.
Absolutely. So we do, when we're going back this far, we're relying on observations from Islamic astronomy and also from Chinese astronomers to piece together the puzzle. You don't have this sort of regular and telescopic observations of the night sky until the 17th century onwards.
Now, we still have two options to look at. Well, let's go for supernova next.
Ah, so supernova. Now, this would be a wonderful one if it fit the bill, if it actually matched up. So a supernova explosion is when a particularly massive star comes towards the end of its lifetime and explodes out in a supernova explosion. And sometimes they end up resulting in a neutron star, this incredibly dense star, or even a black hole. So they're fantastic objects for us astronomers to study. But the basic idea is that you would notice if there was a star in our galaxy that had exploded, and it would last for weeks and months, and potentially a bright one can even be seen during the daytime sky. Chinese astronomers in 1054 AD, they noted down a star that they could see during the daytime. But again, when coming to our time period, there wasn't a spectacular nova noticed, but there was one noted down as being at 5 BC. And I guess it comes down to what is noted as being significant. The wise men, apparently, you know, they were well versed in astronomy, and perhaps they did hold that as being significant.
So they may have been astronomers themselves.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's one of the things, if it was noted as being significant to them, this might be something that, especially when we look at what's written down, King Herod had to be told what this particular sign was. It wasn't that he was just looking out the window and noticed it himself. So this may not have to be of something so spectacular as a bright supernova.
I'm chatting this evening with Brendan Owens, astronomer at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich in London. Well, have you been saving the best to last? The fourth phenomenon, the possibility of planets in alignment.
I think this one is the one that personally excites me the most as well, and is very, very significant, and may even have there's maybe a secret to unlock in the name of saying the Christmas star or the Star of Bethlehem, because planets were originally known as wandering stars. So even when we refer to stars back then, you might not necessarily be referring to a star as we know it today. And during this time period of between 2 BC and all the way back to 7 BC, we have alignments of the planets Jupiter and Saturn three times over the years from 6 BC back to 7 BC. We have Jupiter, Saturn and Mars in the same part of the sky in 6 BC. And then getting a little more recent to 2 BC, with Jupiter and Venus together in the sky, a spectacular sight to see. Venus is the brightest planet in the sky and the brightest object to see apart from the full moon in the sky. So Jupiter being also a very bright planet in the sky, those two together, if they're incredibly close and almost bleed into one, they could look like one very bright star in the sky. So I think this is the most spectacular feature that we could have representing the Star of Bethlehem.
Brendan, how did a man from Ballybay in Monaghan find himself in the Royal Observatory in Greenwich?
Well, I guess if I go all the way back, it comes to going to school in Castleblaney in Our Lady's secondary school there. My physics teacher, Jimmy Brophy, was a big inspiration, sort of set me on my path of exploration in physics and astronomy. And then I went to do work experience at Armagh Observatory. And I really got the bug for talking about astronomy. But I also did my degree in physics and astronomy at Dublin City University. Followed that one up with a master's in science communication, put the two together, and I saw a job come up for astronomy programs assistant at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, and that's where the journey started, and that's coming up over 7 years ago now.
Were you that little boy with a telescope?
Well, to be honest, it was looking at my parents got me the National Geographic, and seeing the front covers of those and seeing what the Hubble Space Telescope was seeing was absolutely amazing. I was fascinated by the Apollo missions, and I did go out the back garden and go looking for the great big bear in the sky and that sort of thing.
Now, with Christmas coming, we may not necessarily see any stars in the sky of note, but I believe we're in for a couple of supermoons.
That's right. We actually are a great treat after we've sort of had our Christmas celebrations just into the new year. On January 1st and into the 2nd of January, we have a supermoon, followed by at the end of the month, 31st of January, another supermoon. And these, they get a lot of visibility, because when you have a name like supermoon, it definitely piques interest. And it is when the moon is a little bit closer to us than usual, because the moon doesn't go around the Earth in a perfect circle. It's more like an ellipse. So it comes a little bit closer to us and goes a little bit further away, and can appear at its closest 30% brighter than a normal full moon. So very, very spectacular sight to see. A great one for people to get photographs of as the moon is rising over in the east.
And of course, every now and then, an occasional blue moon.
That's right. And that's what we have in our first month of 2018, with two supermoons. Not only are they supermoons, but the very fact of having a second full moon in a month is called a blue moon. That's giving rise to that old phrase of once in a blue moon. So we have, a blue supermoon.
A great song, too.
Absolutely.
What is it actually like in the working in the observatory? Because I'm imagining that there's so much history there going right back to its foundation.
It is. Actually, it still sends shivers up my spine when I walk around in the buildings and imagine what it's like for the Astronomers Royal to have walked through there and nipped out to use the telescopes to observe the nighttime sky. It is rich in history.
Now, one of the phenomena, of course, that's been very much debated recently for people who are religious or have a faith is, what about if there is life on other planets? Will that change the whole foundation for people's religious beliefs?
Well, it is a very big question. Is there life out there? And this idea that, you know, are we alone? It's a big question. I find it's an exciting one, because we've been looking out there and we've discovered thousands of planets going around other stars, but we have yet to detect signs of life. And even as we get to the next generation of telescopes, we're still going to be debatable what can be considered life. And when we go from complex organic molecules right through to what we think of as life. But it definitely would be a major game changer in people's perspective on ourselves, on Earth and of the universe.
Okay, Brendan, it's time for you to nail your colours to the mast. Let's go back to the Star of Bethlehem. Do you believe it happened? And if you did, what was your hunch?
Well, I think, you know, as much as I can say from what we chatted about this evening is that there are many good candidates out there. But I think until historians pin down an exact date, I don't have a number one that I could be confident in. But my favourite candidate, my one I'm pinning my colours to as most likely, is a planetary alignment of two planets that appear as one star in the sky.
Brendan Owens, astronomer at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich in London. Thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you very much.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. We'll be back with you next week at the same time when we'll be looking at the spiritual influences on the music of U2. From all of us here tonight, good night.
And the stranger spoke. He said, do not fear. I come from a planet a long way from here. And I bring a message for mankind to hear. Suddenly the sweetest music